The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
All right, back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha on Twitter at Cold Omaha MN. I'm your host, Brandon Warren. I am on Twitter at Brandon underscore Warren. Back in the producer's chair with a working microphone this time around
is nice.
Tom Schreier at T Schreier 3, co-founder of Cold Omaha and the new zonecoverage.com.
Yeah, it's basically just a rebrand. Cold Omaha is still there. We'll operate very similarly. We'll just do some funny stuff with Zone Coverage here pretty soon.
And so now, before we bring our guest on, I do have a little something to share with you all.
Panda, 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 panda. I get broads in Atlanta, chasing
the bleeding shit, sipping fun. We're joined by Pete Leeson at PandaPete21.
Can you hear that? I don't even know if you can hear it over the phone.
I might need that for my own usage.
Oh. We were recording the Cold Omaha staff podcast. We have a meeting every Tuesday before we record this, and I was kicking around some ideas of how I was going to introduce you to the program, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to find the song. And then Sam Ekstrom, who is left and he's going about his day, said, oh, you got to find the Alex Trebek version. And so they had a it must have been a week or two ago, they did a rap category. And so
it's amazing.
I think Trebek had to do Started From the Bottom, Now We Hear, which is a Drake song. I don't like Drake. People are probably going to be upset about that. But I believe that's a Drake song that that Mike Trout used to walk up to the plate. So you likey?
Oh, that's absolutely fantastic. And really just watching the whole segment of Alex Trebek having to read rap lyrics in his dry delivery. I mean, because the guy really doesn't get excited until after he's done asking questions. He's very, like, on point, even keel. So him going panda, 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 it made my day.
Well, and he's literally, like, 79 or 80 years old, too.
Yeah. He's from Canada, too.
I think that sounds about right.
Yeah.
So you can find Pete, now tell me if this is wrong, 94.9 The Breeze and Albert Lee?
Yes, that is correct.
So you do the morning show. When I was looking at the website, you were on the air. What time do you have to get there every morning, or what's your shift look like every day?
Usually I'm in about 5:30, on air at 6 o'clock, so it gives me some time to prep and get everything that I need for the day done. Then after that, I get all the afternoon and evening programming done. So I'm usually out of the office by about 1:30, which is hashtag nice. Well, not
yeah, well.
That kind of nice, but... it's nice.
So how much show prep for the next day do you do the day before, or is it all done the morning of?
Usually I do most of it the morning of, because TV shows, whether it's reality TV, the Oscars, things like that, usually don't happen until night. And when they're done is about when I'm ready to go to bed, so I don't really get a whole lot of time to prep. So I usually use the morning to get everything ready and then get everything to go. And I've got a stack of show prep. I save it for the week just in case I run out of anything, or if it's a light day in Hollywood.
So what time are you getting out of bed every morning then?
First alarm goes off at 4:15, and then the snooze alarm goes off at about 4:45.
Wow. And now you guys had some snow. You got the storm that we didn't get, if I recall correctly, right?
Yeah, we got that on Friday. So we knew it was coming because our forecast wasn't changing. Up in the cities a little bit further north, it kept, like, downgrading as the storm got closer. So me and my genius, I decided I was going to do a lot of work on Thursday, because I think there's two or three people in my apartment complex that leave around in that 5 to 6 o'clock hour, somewhere in there, but they usually don't come out and plow us out until about 7:30, 8 o'clock. So knowing that ahead of time, I'm like, you know what, I'm just gonna get work done, just take it nice and easy. Tried to get out, got my car stuck, so I spent about 40 minutes trying to dig myself back into my spot. And then the plow came by about three or four times from the city and built up this nice 5-foot wall of impossibleness. Because I don't have a truck or an SUV, so it just makes it really hard to get out. And I'd rather not shatter my bumper to get to work at like 5 in the morning. So, Yeah, it was fun. I love winter in Minnesota. It's great.
So did you still make it to work that day, though?
Yeah, I made it to work a little bit later than that, and then I just got a whole bunch of other work done, covered, because everybody was kind of coming in as they were able to get out of the big snowpocalypse that we had.
What's the snow situation there now? I mean, on the ground, is it still pretty substantive?
Mostly melting now off the roads. There's still some. We're going to get back up into the 50s again this weekend, so it should be all gone by then. A little bit of rain, very light precipitation in the forecast through the week, too, so nothing too terrible.
So you do a Twins and Losses podcast with a wide cast of characters. What goes into that? Who are you on there with, and how often are you guys recording? You know, what's your primary bit there?
Well, we're part of the 40 Podcast Network. I do it with my co-host, one of my actual longtime friends, Dan McCarthy. I've known him since I was in second grade and he was in first grade, so we've been friends for a very long time. Both huge baseball fans as well, too. We usually try to get out to a couple games each and every season, although the year I spent in Iowa, I wasn't able to make it out to a game, which was a bummer. But that was also 2013, so I don't think I missed too terribly much by not going to a game. But yeah, so we'll sit down. Usually we record every other Tuesday, or we release a new show every other Tuesday. I try to fit in guests as best as I can based on their schedules, knowing that everybody else is kind of busy. Now, I feel like with you, when we get you back on the show, we're going to have to put a little bit more foresight into that, because you have a child on the way, and that apparently makes things harder to get that 10, 15 minutes of free time.
Have heard that.
Yeah, but we'll usually start planning about Monday. We usually record Friday or Saturday night, depending on what our availability is. And with the availability of the guests, we actually just released a show today at 8 a.m., and we featured some Cold Omaha guys, actually, Giles Farrell and Ben Remington.
Yeah, Ben was just here for the meeting and mentioned that. He remembered him. I said I was having Pete Leeson on, and Tom says, "Who's Pete Leeson?"
Yeah.
Well, I had to say the panda, and he's okay. I got it.
I know the panda.
Yeah.
So we just had those guys on. Talked a little Wild. Talked some Minnesota Twins. A lot of the Major League rule baseball proposed changes that really don't impress me in the least. So we cover a lot of that, but we'll try to get whatever we can for Twins. We do it all year round. One of the nice things, though, with doing it every other week is that we usually have enough topics to cover. And then when the Twin season rolls around, we hit that pretty hard and heavy. And then hopefully we'll have a nice Wild playoff run and maybe a Wolves playoff run as well to talk about this year, too. So we bring in some people for those different things. But, yeah, we come together. And then every now and again, we do have our podcast company owner, Stubby J. He's on. And then usually that devolves into, like, food and video games without a doubt, because he sidetracks us very easily. But that's one of the nice things about having your own show, is that you can do whatever you want to and nobody's going to say anything about it.
What about those Wild? You mentioned the Minnesota Wild, obviously a big win last night with big goal from Mikhail Granlund to seal it. We mentioned on the podcast before this that they played the Kings and the Wolves played the Kings last night, so one of those oddities as well. But been quite a season. Obviously the Martin Hansel trade, obviously a big deal as well. Are you all aboard the bandwagon right now? I mean, again, I know you're not a Fairweather fan, but it's hard not to get too enthused about this team based on how they've played this year.
I feel like I'm at about 95% right now in terms of how excited I am about this team, because as a Minnesota sports fan, you have that 5% of you that will never fully commit to a sports team. The Wild could be like 72-0 right now, and I would still go, well, there's the off chance that something really terrible could happen.
Or the Blackhawks still exist.
Like the Mumps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you lose Zach Parise and Jason Pominville. And again, a lot of people aren't as enthused about Zach Parise as they were when he first came here. Jason Pominville has definitely fallen out of most fans' favor as well. But when you have two veterans on the team that were having, or at least getting their seasons back on track with what you would kind of expect production-wise, and then to lose them to the Mumps after a bye week as well, it really is one of those things where you go, I really hope it's those two. They get back from it very quickly, and nobody else goes down. Because if you remember, was it 2013, I think?
Or 14.
14, when like half the team went down with Mumps, and it was the Minnesota/Iowa Wild that were playing a few games for the team at that point. It's just not something you want to deal with, especially with that bye week now. Chicago has kind of crept back up in terms of, I think they're 3 points behind the Wild, possibly five. I don't know if they played last night or not, but they're getting closer, and they're still a team that's getting better. They're not as dominant as they have been in the past, You can see that based on the cap restrictions that they have by signing Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane to those large contracts to keep those two together. Also the money they gave to Corey Crawford. And we've seen some of those players that have done really well against the Wild start to go out to different teams because they just can't afford to keep them. However, they still have Jonathan Toews, they still have Patrick Kane, they still have Corey Crawford, and it just feels like at this time the Chicago Blackhawks are kind of the New York Yankees to the Minnesota Wild in that even if they're bad, you still fear that game no matter what the circumstances are because it seems like they're just able to take on the Wild and play at least the same level as what the Wild are giving, if not a better level.
Yeah, it's amazing what that Blackhawks team has been able to do since they parted out that first Stanley Cup team with Dustin Byfuglien and all those guys. And so, yeah, you know, if you keep your stars, that's
basically... I mean, the Wild don't have a Kane or a Toews. Like, they just don't have a player at that level.
But they have financially a Kane or a Toews in Parise and Suter, right?
Yeah.
I mean, are they making similar money?
You guys are baseball guys. Isn't Parise on the... He seems to be on the Joe Mauer track where he's going to, like, his back may give out and he's going to have this big contract where...
How many years is left? Are there, like, six?
I think he's 5 years in. Does that sound right?
I don't know. I mean, lots of time left on both of these deals where...
I mean, I love Parise. I think, if anything, his best trait, which is a two-way forward, is going to be his downfall.
Yeah. I don't know if he can keep that up forever.
Well, and I think one of the big things, too, is that when you have those local heroes, you almost don't want to see them kind of come to the end, which was why it was nice to see Dave Winfield, Paul Molitor come back to the Twins towards the end of their career. Yes, you paid attention to what they were doing, but it was a little bit harder to watch Dave Winfield, a little bit harder to watch Paul Molitor back in the early mid-90s before they were with the Twins. And being able to see Joe Mauer, being able to see more into Mauer's life and how he's handling injuries, and the same thing with Zach Parise, the advent of social media has really put a lot of athletes under more scrutiny than they probably would have been.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like with Kirby Puckett and some of the off-the-field things that he got into post-playing career with Randy Moss and what he was doing, you know, while he was with the Vikings and even some of the stuff out in Oakland as well, social media wasn't nearly as big, so the ability for us to get the news of all the little things that they were doing was a lot harder. And it's hard to believe, but there was a time when cell phones had very terrible cameras or no cameras.
No.
So people couldn't just record things as they were happening. They couldn't tweet things as they were happening. So we have like this, we'll say pre-2004 opinion of athletes, and then the post-2004 with social media, camera phones, all these other kind of things really coming into play. So I think that's why Joe Mauer and Zach Parise have been getting such a beating, is because social media exists today, where if Kirby Puckett was doing some of those things back in 1995 through 2003 or so, that probably would have been under as much scrutiny, if not more, because there just wasn't a way to as easily report things as you can now.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that it's certainly altered the landscape of how we view things, and maybe not for the better. We talked about the Wild, where the Wild send their minor leaguers is Iowa. You spent almost a year in Iowa doing your thing before you were called up to the big league, so to speak. You're back to Minnesota, back to a very respectable state. What was living in Iowa like?
Corn and beer league softball was really, and working out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is kind of my trajectory right now, is that I moved down to Iowa, a little city called Denison, about 5,000-6,000 people, one of the bigger areas in southwest Iowa. And when I moved down there, Donna Reed was the celebrity from Denison, Iowa. For those of you that were born, you know, basically after 1960, Donna Reed was in It's a Wonderful Life, the Christmas movie in black and white that everybody watches. So that was kind of their claim to fame, was that it was Donna Reed. And then I got the call up. We'll say, so if that was single A, not rookie ball, that was single A. Then I came up to the double A's here in Albert Lea, and Marion Ross, better known as Mrs. Cunningham from Happy Days, was actually, I don't know, like necessarily born here, but spent a good part of her like childhood years and teenage years in Albert Lea. So that's kind of the trajectory right now, is that I have to find like my AAA station needs to have like a very popular female actress. That's kind of where I need to go next. And then when I do get to the majors, I feel like I'll have a much easier time being able to pick out the celebrities from those cities there.
That seems like a good career goal. So you probably have certain cities picked out?
Yeah, it's the next one would kind of be like your Des Moines, your Omahas, those slightly larger, but not quite like Minneapolis, St. Paul, because those are very big markets. And if you ever listened to Twin Cities Radio, you know that there's not generally a lot of turnaround at those stations.
No.
So it's really just working your way up, knowing the right people, hoping that you get lucky with an interview or that somebody that you know at a station is able to go, hey, we should get this guy. And then they go, well, you know, 6 foot tall Asian, that's out of the ordinary, so let's go with him and see how that works out.
So is that on your master reel then? Something about being 6 foot Asian?
No, but because isn't that like, I don't know, I try not to put like all that information on there because I don't want it to be like, hey, I got into college that I probably shouldn't have gone to because I'm Korean versus like, hey, I got in because of my merits because I'm really academically smart.
Oh, yeah, like affirmative action or something.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. So I try not to, but if it comes up, if you see me face-to-face, I'm a little bit a darker shade than like the majority of people around the Midwest.
So are you going to be in town tonight for the SmackDown taping?
No, I wish I was, but They tape SmackDown, and then they now do the network exclusive 205 Live after. So SmackDown ends about 9:05. 205 Live ends at like 10:30. So like the whole 10:30. So get to your car and probably leave by about 11 o'clock. Then drive an hour and a half back to Albert Lea, and then like sleep for 3.5 hours and go to work. Didn't really seem that appealing, but this weekend, I'll actually be out in La Crosse for a SmackDown house show. And then on Sunday, my buddy Isaac and I, we're driving out to Milwaukee to go to the Fastlane pay-per-view.
Oh, well, that sounds like fun. I got to see Buried Alive 1 year at Target Center. I want to say it was an Undertaker-Kane match, but then Dolph Ziggler stole the show with, I think, Daniel Bryan in the first match, which is amazing when those guys do it. But a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. It's watching it on TV is one thing, but actually being in the arena is a totally different experience. It's just a different energy. It's a lot more fun. And if you've never been to a live show of any sort, I'd highly recommend that you go. But just remember that wrestling is quote unquote fake, like everything else on TV that you watch. So just go with that in mind as well.
So the Childish Gambino album is no longer new, but it is still on the rotation for me. I know you're a big fan of his. What was your, now that we've let it breathe a little bit, what was your grade for that album? What was your takeaway from it?
I would give it a solid A-. It really was an album I didn't know that I wanted. And then when I heard it, I'm like, this is exactly what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
He's had such an eclectic rise back from some of his very, very early stuff that he was doing himself. And then when he kind of got that mainstream appeal with, was it Camp, I believe?
It was mixtapes, and then it was Camp, and then it was Because of the Internet.
Yeah, and then so for me, it was like it's watching this progression of him, and it's seeing how his creative mind works in that he wasn't just going to be like a stereotypical rapper, that he was willing to try more things. But I wouldn't put him in like that category of like the Beatles quite yet in terms of like how they transformed from like very British proper pop into their more psychedelic rock and everything that they were doing towards the later part of his career. But he has that same kind of trajectory in terms of from where he started to where he was now. As a drummer, I'm a huge fan of like funk and soul and R&B from back in the 60s, 70s, and even the early 80s, because a lot of those beats are just lights out. They're not complicated, but they just sound really great, and then everything else that they put around it too. So the fact that he was able to do kind of like this funk, soul, R&B sort of album right after he'd done Because of the Internet, which was a little bit more experimental hip-hop rap kind of album, and then his more traditional Camp, and then his mixtapes where it really was kind of that underground, gritty rap sound, it really shows like how he views his music career and how he doesn't want to be just pigeonholed into one thing, which is part of the allure of Donald Glover, for me, Childish Gambino, is that he's just willing to do such different things, whether it's Community or his new TV show Atlanta or being Lando Calrissian in the new young Han Solo movie. He really doesn't have he's not getting himself typecast at this point in his career, which I think is great for somebody who's willing to express themselves in lots of different artistic ways.
I think for somebody who has trouble identifying himself he's done a good job to put himself into spots where it's like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, like you said, the underground stuff fit that bill, and you know, and then he just kind of followed a progression, and so I think he's done a nice job with that.
Yeah, I really like what he's done, and you know, if I have to wait another 2 years for a new album from him, it's the one thing too that I really like is that everything he does is quality.
Mm-hmm.
He's not putting out quantity like some artists do, where it's like, all right, well, it's been that year and 2 months. We've got to get your next album out. Here's the songs we're going to record, and then we're going to go on tour. You know, it's guys like Childish Gambino, the Foo Fighters, a lot of those big bands that know that they can take their time to put music out, and people will still eat it up. They'll still go to the shows, but you enjoy it because it's not just force-fed. And it's not that all of the force-fed music is bad. It's just that it gets to a point where you just get burnt out from it. You're just tired of it, and you like that little bit of time to breathe. I mean, people were craving a new Frank Ocean album, and then he's like, oh, by the way, here you go. And it's like people went insane
mm-hmm.
when he dropped his album. So I feel like Childish Gambino is in that same kind of category where he's just going to put out music when he feels it's appropriate, and it's not going to be anything that he doesn't deem worthy of being put out into the public.
I feel like the album was largely, and tell me if you disagree, just come out and say it. I feel like the album was largely geared towards his baby son, and I don't know if I'd call it like a love album or like a love, you know, a love song to someone, but almost an entire album, but just kind of dictating a lot of stuff about him, you know, his relationship with the child's mom. You know, obviously there's a couple songs about that. There's a song about how to handle people when they treat you poorly. I just felt like a lot of it was geared, you know, obviously not for the ears of someone that age, but, you know, something to give to his son later and say, this was for you.
Yeah, and I can definitely see that too because, you know, I always got like those 70s, 60s, 80s kind of funk R&B and soul feel from it. And
especially Boogeyman. The beginning of Boogeyman, I felt, had that almost like an African folk music vibe too, some of the songs.
Yeah, and when you get into Riot, that really felt like kind of the pinnacle of funk like in the mid-70s or so. And, you know, then you go back into like Redbone and, you know, The Night Me and Your Mama Met and things like that. You know, it just felt like he was studying or listening to certain music, and then it just all kind of clicked for him, and then that's when the writing process started. That's when the recording happened as well. I wasn't able to go out to that concert that he did out in California. I can't remember the venue itself, but I did watch some of it on YouTube. I believe they put out some different parts of it too. And just the way that he acts as a showman on the stage and the way that he puts everything together too, it's like he understands what he's doing when he's out there. And I'm sure that being a comedian, you know, and still being a comedian to an extent, helped him with that. But just the way that he holds himself on stage, the way that he put this album together, you can definitely tell that he put a lot of heart and soul into it, and that this was something that he was doing for himself and for the fans at the same time.
What was your favorite song from the album?
I think my favorite song is Riot. Like, I absolutely love Redbone.
Almost like there has to be a non-Redbone category, because I think everybody loves that song.
Yeah, it was the second song that he released. I was out in San Diego. I went to California in the middle of winter brag.
Yep, sweet brag there, dude.
But when he released it, he did the first one, which was Me and Your Mama, and then he did Redbone, I think, a little bit later when I was out there, too. And I loaded up my phone with a bunch of different music because I went out there, worked out, which is bizarre to a lot of people. When you go on vacation, that's like the last thing that you want to do.
Yeah, sweet workout brag too, man.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. 13 days, I think I worked out 14 times in there too. So,
yep. Ooh, a couple 13, 14 workouts.
A couple 13, 14. But I listened to those two songs only, like when I was out there for at least a week straight.
Wow.
And I don't know if you're the same way, but like if I listen to the same songs over and over and over again, eventually I just get burnt out from the album and I just put it away for a few months. And then I just kind of listen to things here and there as they come up, if there's a certain song I want to. This is one of the few albums so far. I mean, it came out, what, the second week in December?
I think it was December 2nd.
Yeah, and I have not stopped listening to this album. And I will listen to it from front to back without skipping songs, too. And I think that, to me, is the definition of a great album, because everybody goes, oh, yeah, I really love, you know, album X, but I especially love this song, and this song, which means they're skipping over all of the other ones in between, or they just have a playlist of those songs. And for me, I can listen to this album front to back, not skip a single song, And that's why it was like, this is my album of 2016 and probably 2017, because there are so few albums that I can listen to front to back without skipping songs.
Yeah, another one for me, I've alternated between the song Redbone and then Down by Run the Jewels 3, the first, or by Run the Jewels on Run the Jewels 3, the first song from that album, which came out about 3 weeks after that. And so that was kind of my alternating situation towards the end of the year. But for me, it's Stand Tall, because I just think that it's got such a great message about, you know, sticking with your dreams, and if you're strong, you can't fall. So that song resonates with me for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other group that I've really been into is GTA. It's kind of an electric, I don't know exactly what you quantify them as, but a certain Twins pitcher got me really into them, and I've downloaded a handful of their albums. I've been listening to that in between too, but it's the internet is such a great thing, because it does give you access to all this music that you didn't necessarily have access to before. Brandon, you and I are around the same age. Not entirely sure where Tom fits in there, too. But for
he's actually just under 70. He's 69.
Oh, God.
Nice. Hashtag nice on that one, Tom.
No, feel free to tell us how old.
Yeah, 27.
Oh, well, you're in that same category, too. But, I mean, for us, it was like going to Down in the Valley and looking through CDs, mm-hmm. going to Best Buy when they actually have, like, stacks and stacks of CDs. Now they have, like, this very limited five-row selection of music.
My truck doesn't even have a CD player.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, too. Like, we still had CD players. I remember I had the tape adapter that you would plug into your, like, Walkman or whatever kind of portable CD player you had,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd have to have your buddy hold it, or you would have to hold it in your lap if you went over a bumpy road, which we don't have in Minnesota because we don't have any weather here.
Never.
That impedes construction and road projects, and we have a legislature, too, that passes very good budgets that allow us to work on these things. Wait. I'm thinking of a different state. Either way, yeah, we had that. And then I remember I got my – when I purchased my first car, I replaced the tape deck with a CD deck, because that was the big thing too. And then you'd always take the faceplate off because you didn't want somebody to steal your deck, because you'd put a $150 CD player in like a $500 car.
So yeah, well, I can't remember. I think I had a Pioneer deck. My first night one was a Pioneer.
I think that's what mine was, too. It was like it had blue and white lettering, which was cool because it was two colors you could pick from.
And they had a case, though. You'd slide it over, pull it off, and then put it in the case, and then put it in the glove box or something so you couldn't see it.
Or you'd throw it in your backpack and carry it with you or whatever it was. But, yeah, that's
completely different times, man.
I don't miss it, but it does. I do get a little nostalgic about that, too.
Okay, so it's a month until MLB The Show comes out. I know you're a big video game guy. I don't know if you do sports games at all, but, you know, what are you getting excited about video game-wise?
The new Mass Effect looks really, really fun.
Tom's pumping his fist, which...
Yeah,
Andromeda. Oops, well, shit.
Whatever. Oh, geez, now you just dropped an S-bomb. I'm going to get that explicit
Sorry.
I'm going to be in the lab trying to get this damn label off.
It wasn't even my fault this time. So
We are. We're in the lab with a pen and a pad trying to get this damn label off. We're like Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
Freaking Tom. Anyway, back to Mass Effect.
Sorry, Mass Effect's great, man.
I got the dumb Mass Effect across the table from me. We are derailed.
Yeah. Mass Effect Andromeda seems like it'll be a very fun game. Actually, when I get home, I'm going to download the newest DLC for The Division, which I just started playing again. They've really changed a lot of why I quit playing the game when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually pumped about that. Outside of that, I'm still debating on whether or not I want to get a Nintendo Switch. The idea of it seems very cool and appealing to me, but the actual implementation is yet to be seen. So I'm going to be waiting a little bit for that. I've been playing a lot of Overwatch, courtesy of one Major League Baseball pitcher as well.
Yeah, we'll be asking you about that pitcher, by the way.
It's really hard because, like, when you're a kid, you look forward to being an adult because you're like, I'm going to drink chocolate milk all day long, and I'm going to play video games all day, and I'm going to sleep in. And it's like, okay, actually, bud, you're getting up at, like, 4:15 every day. Go to the gym after work. Then you come home, make dinner. By the time you're done with dinner, you're, like, too tired to actually want to play video games. So you, like, kind of play through something for an hour, and then you just, like, sit down and go, what am I doing with my life? And then you go to bed and wake up and do it all over again. So... my expectations of being an adult as a child have greatly, I don't know what the proper word is, they haven't lived up to what it actually is like.
So let's talk a little baseball. Obviously the Twins in spring training, as we're recording, playing against the Tampa Bay Rays. Hector Santiago is getting lit up. Don't put too much stock into spring training stats, but it is, you know, it's a way to kind of see where guys are at. What's your level of excitement for spring training this year?
It's probably like a B+. I don't, like you, I don't read too much into what they do in spring training, but it's seeing, you know, if Glenn Perkins is healthy. It's seeing what Phil Hughes can do. It's really more or less seeing what kind of the veterans, you know, what shape the veterans are in, guys that were injured for good chunks of the year, where they're at right now. Kyle Gibson is probably one of my bigger storylines this year because he was kind of touted as one of these big guys coming up. He hasn't lived up to expectations yet. Been around the club for now three and a half seasons. So I want to see where he's at. He's had some injuries as well, and the new throwing regiment that he's on is new and different. It's seeing if they're going to install like a dispensable barf bag thing in the bullpen for Ryan O'Rourke.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then it's also to see if they're going to reinforce anything if Byung-ho Park keeps mashing taters down in spring training too, because he's already got, what is it, 2 home runs and like 8 at-bats, I think, which is, you know, positive sign. But then it's also seeing, you know, what Byron Buxton is doing, what Miguel Sano is doing, Jose Barrios as well, just some of these younger guys that have struggled a bit since they've been called up, or at least, you know, are on the cusp of being called up full-time. And outside of that, you know, wins and losses don't really matter. I just want to see these guys go out and at least look like they know what they're doing when they're out in spring training.
So what's your level of enthusiasm for Byung-ho Park this season? Obviously, you know, good early stuff on the film, so to speak. But, you know, the issues last year were clear and obvious. The big thing that I found this year that people have been tweeting about, a home run on a 96-mile-an-hour fastball, home run on a 93-mile-per-hour fastball, it's, you know, he's shown the ability to hit higher-end velocity this season, or at least so far this spring. You know, what are your expectations out of him this season, and what are you hoping to see?
If he doesn't break camp with the Twins, I'm not going to be heartbroken about it. You know, I'm
even if he was on the roster, he might not have done that,
right?
Frankly.
So for me, it's seeing that, okay, is he healthy? Because there was the wrist injury. And then it's seeing, is he doing the things that he's supposed to do to become a better Major League Baseball player? We know he can play baseball in Korea. We know that he's very good in Korea, but the major leagues are different. And he had a very good April and part of May, and then things derailed very quickly for him. And then depending on when he actually was injured, if that factors into it too, but ultimately he did not have a great freshman campaign with the Minnesota Twins. So for me, if he goes down to AAA, I want to see him be a better player than a 21-year-old or 22-year-old who's just getting their first taste of AAA. Byung-ho Park is 30 going on 31. You hope that he's coming along much quicker now that he's kind of acclimated to the American culture. He's getting a little bit more familiar with his surroundings and settings. So to me, if he's, you know, maybe a post-All-Star break call-up, if things aren't quite going the way that he wants to, that would be a good sign for me that he maybe has some ability to be an effective player at the Major League level. If not, you know, it was worth a shot, and really we didn't pay that much money for him. So, you know, I guess to me it still seems like it's a better experiment than the other Asian player that we had a few years ago who was a totally different case, and they're not from the same country.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the people forget that. I'm not trying to be coy or cheeky with
the
joke.
The
people are just dumb.
You know, the comments that you get, Mike Berardino, all the guys that are writing, even me sometimes too, people forget that Tsuyoshi Nishioka is from Japan, Byung-ho Park is from Korea. Nishioka played in the Japanese Baseball League, and Byung-ho Park played in the Korean Baseball Organization.
Yeah, the
and they're two different leagues from two different countries. So you tried it with one guy, it didn't work out. And then in the same breath, too, then are you going to start yelling at all like the guys that we drafted that didn't work out? Like, are you going to start getting down on your Brendan Harris's and your Matt Tolberts and all these other...
Well, how about the any international player? Okay, well, Miguel Sano's an international player.
Yeah.
And Jorge Polanco.
Yeah.
And Max Kepler. And,
yeah,
by the way, those three guys were signed in the same international class. I think Fernando Romero was right around then as well. It might have been even the same year. So it's like, yeah, maybe you're just being ignorant.
Yeah, I don't... And maybe it's the fact, too, that, like, the amount of Asian-bred baseball players are generally not high in the major leagues right now. And I think the problem, too, is that everybody wants to equate any Asian player, regardless of where they came from, what league they played, how old they are, whatever it is, to Ichiro.
Yeah. or Hideki Matsui.
Yeah.
You know, Kaz Matsui was a big-time bust for the Mets because everybody expected him to come over and hit 30 bombs because he had crazy power over there. And so it's always about comps. Well, they just kind of look the same. Like, that doesn't mean that they're related or even from the same country. It's so stupid.
No, Brandon. We're all from the same country. We're actually... So there were two Asian people that came down from the heavens, and then they...
It's a vast conspiracy, trust me.
Yeah, they went fishing. They weren't supposed to go fishing, but they went fishy, and that's how they got sushi. And from that, it spawned, you know, Sony TVs.
Samsung.
Yeah, Samsung, all of these different things. So after China was too populated, then they went out to, you know, Japan. And the Philippines and Laos and Vietnam and all these other places, too. Or wait, that's a different book. Never mind. Sorry about that.
So how much does the acclimation process, in your opinion, matter for Byung-ho Park? I mean, he wasn't around very long before he started to struggle. And that's the other thing, too. You know, he didn't have time to overcome those struggles like Jung-ho Kang had, obviously a fellow countryman who had played in the KBO and played better in the second half of his first year. How much do those things really matter, in your opinion, as far as coming over from overseas? You know, there is, I'm sure, a significant culture shock, but they do try to cushion it as much as possible because obviously big league teams have amenities and budgets that are far reaching beyond what we could imagine.
I think it matters, maybe not as much as people expect it to, but I think it does play a part. If when you were a kid, you went away to summer camp, maybe you were gone 1, 2, 3 weeks, even a month, if you went on one of those longer trips,
sure.
And you get homesick. You know, it's getting used to routine that's similar but not the same as what you're used to back home, whether it's, you know, in Korea, whether it's Roseau or, you know, wherever.
Sure.
And so it's just getting used to that. It's getting used to new people. You know, when you think about Byung-ho Park, he doesn't know any of these guys. He's never met any of these players before. It's not like he'd been drafted when he was 20 years old, you know, started down at Rookie A, made it up to Fort Myers, then he spent some time Cedar Rapids, anything like that. He literally came over 1 year from Korea and then started meeting brand new people, learning a different language. You know, they have translator. It's a different translator, I believe, this year, too. It's not the same one that they had last year.
No, they were working on hiring one. I think they may have hired one, but I know it's not going to be the same one.
Yeah. You know, so it's doing all these things, and then it's getting used to driving on a different side of the road, getting used to ordering food off of menus, going grocery shopping, all these other things that we all take for granted. But if you've ever gone traveling to a different country, even if it's an English-speaking country, each country is different. So I do think that that plays a part. It might not be the end-all, be-all part because, again, he's been playing baseball for a long time. He understands how that portion of it works. But again, it's getting used to all the differences between the Korean baseball organization versus Major League Baseball and the little things that go along, because when he was planning on coming over, one of the things he got rid of was his bat flip. And that was a part of what he was capable of, you know, the difference between the Korean baseball organization and MLB is that they bat flip all the time over there. So that was one of the things that if he wanted to play in Major League Baseball, he took it upon himself to get rid of the bat flip so that a team wouldn't go, well, he's going to flip his bat, get, you know, somebody's going to get beaned and we're going to go through a brawl, you know, hopefully 40, 50 times in a season. So he changed things over there, but changing things in your native country and then coming over and actually putting them into implementation are two totally different things.
So let's move on from Park here, and I do want to ask you about your other, I don't know if I'd call it a man crush. If you've got the guy's face on a T-shirt, I think it probably qualifies. But what are your expectations for Trevor May this year?
Really hoping he sneaks in as the fifth starter in the rotation. I don't want to see him in the bullpen in any capacity, even if it means that he has to stay down in Florida for a little bit longer or head over to Rochester once mm-hmm. camp breaks. I just think that with Derek Falvey, Thad Levine, Paul Molitor, Neil Allen, Eddie Guardado, all these guys looking at what happened last year and then seeing, I think it was Mike Berardino that had the write-up, or no, maybe it was Phil Miller. I can't remember. One of the baseball, or Lavelle, I think, actually. Sorry. Came out like in January before Twins Fest or right around Twins Fest and said that Trevor May was going to get a legitimate shot at the starting rotation. And just seeing all the different quotes that have come out since then saying, you know, maybe he didn't have the best shot last year and then there were a lot of circumstances that happened that we didn't necessarily give him a fair chance. So the fact that they can even look back at last year and see what they did and where it's going forward, I think that's a good thing because, you know, I don't necessarily think Hector Santiago is that big of an upgrade over Ricky Nolasco. Phil Hughes was injured for a good chunk of last year, and we don't know what he's capable of doing. Then you have Kyle Gibson, who looks great for stretches and then doesn't look so great, and sometimes he gets hurt on top of that, too. I mean, I saw a lot of people really putting together, like, their preemptive, you know, kind of opening day rosters, and the names on the list almost shocked me. Like, all of these players were guaranteed to make the starting rotation based on the fact that they're owed a lot of money. And I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case under Levine and Falvey, is that I'm hoping that because they're more analytical, they're looking at a lot of different things other than necessarily your traditional stats, that they're willing to give guys a chance, not because they have a lot of money attached to their name, but because they give a team that lost 103 games last year the best chance to not lose 103 games this upcoming year. And I think one of the big question marks, too, is what Berríos is going to be capable of, because, yes, he did get his first taste of the major leagues, but he didn't necessarily look great. So I don't know that it's as an open and shut case as people are thinking. And if Trevor can really go out there and do the things that he was doing, you know, what was that, Saturday or Sunday when he had his first start, and then continue to do that through spring training, I think you'd be doing a disservice to the team and Trevor by not at least giving him the opportunity to break camp with the team in the starting rotation and then see where things go from there. It's 162 games. It's a very long season. We know that not everybody's going to make it through the year without being injured at some point or dinged up, miss a couple starts here and there. So I really hope that he just gets a legitimate shot to be a starter this year in whatever capacity it might be.
And we talked about Gibson and May and Berríos. Now, I think each of those guys are going to stand to benefit from working with Jason Castro. You know, what are you thinking as far as that is concerned? Because my feeling that I've kind of echoed on here a handful of times is that he'll raise the water level or the level that guys float at as far as their floors in terms of what they're capable of. And that'll help, you know, obviously the rotation had the worst ERA in all of baseball last year. You know, it can only stand to go up from having a good defensive catcher who is very intelligent, obviously went to Stanford, but also a good receiver and just a good game planner. I think, you know, guys like Trevor May, Kyle Gibson, Jose Berríos have a lot to gain from that.
Well, and I think, too, was it Carl Pavano and was Drew Butera kind of his...
Yep, that was his caddy.
His battery mate.
Yep.
So, I mean, you look at what that was, and I mean, at the time, Joe Mauer was still catching, and he was regarded as one of the better defensive catchers in Major League Baseball, too. So you have, you know, these different guys that have come through since then. And one of the big things, too, is that, you know, you can even go back to the whole Matt Capps fiasco and everything that was involved there, but we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't have a glass ball, a crystal ball, that was going to tell you the future that, you know, this was going to happen here, that Justin Morneau was going to get concussed, that Joe Mauer was going to get concussed, and all these other things that went along with it, too. So, you know, everybody goes, well, you know, we had Kurt Suzuki. We signed him to an extension. There really wasn't a whole lot of better options out there, at least for the money, in my opinion. So having Kurt Suzuki for a couple seasons seemed like a much better option than just throwing out Mitch Garver, who clearly needed some time to develop down in AAA and AA over the last couple of seasons. I mean, as much as certain people on Twitter love Drew Butera, he probably wasn't going to be the answer for an everyday catcher, which is why he's had such a great career down in Kansas City behind Salvador Perez. So bringing in a guy like Jason Castro, who, again, not going to hit for average, not really going to hit for power, but he'll make the pitchers better, that to me is going to be a step in the right direction because we do have a lot of guys that weren't really hitting the strike zone as consistently as you want. I think Neil Allen was quoted last week as saying something along those same lines too. So if Castro comes in and makes the pitching staff better, at least just in terms of the games that he can call, then I think that's going to help out the team tremendously, and maybe that equates to 3 or 4 more wins than what we would have had last season, but that's the difference between losing 99 games and 103.
The over-under from Vegas that I saw today said, I think, 74.5. If you were a betting man, because I'm sure you're wink-wink not, what would your bet be on a 74.5?
I would take the over, and I'd probably throw down $50.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I mean, I wrote 80. Then I was fed a scoop that a prominent projection system was going to be close to that. And then they actually, I think, went up to 81 eventually after they had plugged in a few other things. And so most of the projections, I think, are 76 to 80, 81. I still think 80 wins is probably where I'm at as far as a this could happen. I think 76 is probably more likely this probably should happen. But I don't know. I think it's I think 500 is in play.
I think the big thing, too, is that this roster still is not that much changed from 2015, where, like we've said, you know, both in many different capacities, that the Twins probably overachieved. Now you have a little bit more mature core in terms of some of these younger players. It seems like they're starting to settle down and get into a groove and become more consistent players. And the fact, too, that it's going to be really hard to be as bad as the Twins were last year with the injuries that went into it, with the fact that they were calling up guys that they were probably hoping to call up, you know, half of them at the end of August, beginning of September with September call-ups, and then they start coming up in April, May, June, July. By the time August came around, there really wasn't anybody else to call up that you'd be giving, you know, a fair shot and a legitimate, like, hey, we're going to call you up because we think you can contribute at the major league level. They put Band-Aids on so many different holes in that ship last year. I just don't think that it's really possible to be that bad unless a whole different set of players or the same set of players break down again this year, which is not anything that I hope that, that happens. But I want to see them play consistent baseball. I want to see them beat teams that they should beat, whether it's a, you know, very much, you know, young and kind of inexperienced Chicago team right now, whether it's beating up on Kansas City as they deal with pitching losses and the death of Yordano Ventura, and their hitting seems to be kind of like in its own special little world right now too. You know, I want to see them win those games, but I also want to see them steal a game from Cleveland every now and again. I want to see them steal a couple games from New York and Boston and some of these other teams, because I think, what is it, you play like 72 or 73 games just against teams in your own division. We should be able to get 50 plus wins off of the AL Central. They're not good. And that's why Cleveland's win total was as inflated as it was.
Well, that was a staple of the Twins of 2003, 4, 5, whatever, is, you know, they hammered Kansas City, hammered Detroit, and then held, you know, stayed above water everywhere else.
Yeah, and so when you look at what Cleveland did, I mean, it was basically the same thing, although I do think the Cleveland Indians are a much deeper team than what the Twins had back then. It's really what the Twins have to do again, is that they have to start hammering on teams that they know they're superior to. And it's not to say that Chicago won't get it along if this whole rebuild that they're doing comes into fruition sooner rather than later. It doesn't mean that Detroit won't make some trades to put themselves back into contention, because that's something that they're prone to do. And it doesn't mean that the Royals won't figure it out this year either, after, you know, a very bad last season. So I want the Twins just to beat up on the teams that they're supposed to. You know, as much as it's going to crush my soul, the Twins should sweep the San Diego Padres in June or July or whenever that game is, because the Padres are a terrible team. I don't think they're nearly as bad as the Twins, but these are the games that you have to win. You can't win two out of the three. You have to sweep the series. You can win two out of three against Detroit because it's an interleague series. They kind of know what to expect. They generally play a little bit tougher, but, I mean, they should be sweeping teams like Tampa. And they should be sweeping teams like the Padres, and all, you know, West Coast trip's going to be a little more brutal than normal this year. But, I mean, that's what I'm looking for, just to see consistency, to see them beat the teams they should, and to steal a couple from teams that they probably shouldn't beat.
So I feel like from 2015 to 2016, virtually the same team. You know, they lost Blaine Boyer, lost Torrey Hunter, but also brought in Byung-Ho Park, who should, you know, in a regular year probably match Torrey Hunter's production on the field. So I feel like the 24-win difference between 59 and 83 boiled down to this is the level of variability in the game today when you put a lot of your trust in young players. And so, you know, it's one of those deals where if young players lose their way, whether it's because they don't realize how difficult it is to stay on top in terms of training and preparing themselves, or, you know, the adjustment and readjustment phase, you know, like where sophomore slumps come from. Now, I feel like it's one of those deals where, yeah, if you put a lot of your eggs in the young player basket, that's the amount of variability that you can have between very, very bad and very, very good, because that young talent is so volatile.
And you look at, too, everybody uses Chris Bryant as an example of what they expect Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano to do. Yes, they were all ranked very highly in the minor leagues coming up, but we've seen so many times that it takes some of these even top prospects time to get acclimated at the major league level, because the difference between being a triple-A-er, even a 4A baller, is totally different than being at the major league level. So not everybody is just going to get it immediately. And I think a lot of people look at the NBA drafts and they look at the NFL drafts and they go, well, these guys come in and they contribute at a high level right away. It rarely happens that way.
Mm-hmm.
With baseball, it can take guys, you know, 2 to 3 years to get called up and play, or it could take them 6, 7, 8. I mean, Chris Colabello didn't get his first call up until he was 29 or 30 years old, and that was a couple seasons ago. Randy Ruiz, I think in 2009 or 10, didn't get called up until he was 30 years old, too. It, just because guys are in the system or they're a certain age or whatever it is, there's no algorithm in terms of calling up a guy and having them be effective right away. Yeah, we probably got spoiled with Justin Morneau and Joe Mauer right out of the gate, but you also had some players that struggled. I don't think Jason Bartlett was, like, phenomenal the moment that he came up. I don't think Jason Kubel, obviously he had the injury,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't, you know, just brilliant right out of the gate either. Michael Kadire struggled a little bit. Torrey Hunter struggled a little bit. I mean, you look at David Ortiz, and there's lots of different things that go into the David Ortiz experiment, but it took him X amount of years at the major leagues and then a little bit of time in Boston to really get going, too, to become the Hall of Fame player that he turned out to be. So it's not a guarantee that guys are just going to come up no matter, well, he's the number one ranked prospect in the minor leagues. Okay. Am I the number one ranked radio broadcaster in the minors? Maybe.
Well, we don't know.
Probably. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean I'm just going to get called up right away and end up in a great market and know exactly what to do. There's a learning curve. It takes time. And everybody's a little bit different. So I'm willing to give these guys like 2017 to figure it out, but if they're looking shaky after 2017, then it's going, okay, what didn't go right in their development? What's not happening at the major league level? Is it the players? Is it the coaching staff? What is it? Because then at that point, I think kind of that 2 to 3 year mark is when you start to question if they're as good as they were touted.
It was a quiet off season. Looked a lot like a Terry Ryan off season, quite frankly. And if you hadn't told fans that there was a new GM or a new PBO, or CBO, sorry, that it would, people would have thought Terry Ryan was in charge still. What was your takeaway from this offseason? How did you grade this offseason in terms of what the Twins did?
I would give it a C. I mean, I don't think that they necessarily improved or got any worse with the offseason that they had. You know, Jason Castro was probably the biggest signing, and they had, was it Ryan Vogelsong and Matt Belisle and Drew Stubbs and some other kind of veterans that have played. The names are familiar, but they're not necessarily going to come in and just challenge for an opening day, you know, roster spot. But I think it shows kind of what, you know, Derek Falvey and Thad Levine think of where the team is right now, that they weren't so set on going out. It's like, we got to make a trade for Zach Greinke, or we have to get King Felix out of Seattle, or, you know, Robinson Cano's not happy in Seattle. We have to get him on the team somehow. And also looking at the fact, too, that they were very staunch in what they wanted for Brian Dozier, and they didn't just give in because they weren't getting it either.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it goes, all right, they don't believe that last year was, you know, the future trend, that they think this team can bounce back with the talent that they have now, that making a couple upgrades here could get them back to that 80-win category again, that could put them at least in wild card contention again. I don't see the Twins catching up to Cleveland, and I don't see Cleveland falling off. Terry Francona is a great manager. They have a solid team intact, and they probably got even more scary when it comes to hitting, because did they not get Edwin Encarnacion and Chris Colabello too?
Right.
So Jason Kipnis, you know, Edwin Encarnacion, Chris Colabello, post-steroids, you know.
Michael Brantley if he's healthy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this isn't the Shusin Chu. This isn't, you know, a lot of the other kind of players that they've had over the last 6, 7, 8 years that just didn't really live up to expectation, but they were still a, you know, competitive club. So I look at what the Twins did in the offseason, and I go, okay, I think this is a year, too, that they're going to sit down and go, what's working and what isn't working? You know, what is our plan going forward, and do these guys fit into the plan going forward? Because you have some expiring contracts. Trevor Plouffe left in the offseason so that they could actually get the Miguel Sano experiment really up off the ground and running. And then they've, you know, got your Trevor Mays, your Jose Barrios, guys that, you know, have been on the cusp but maybe not quite gotten there yet. Even Tyler Duffy, I would consider him to be another guy that's kind of in that, you know, does he fit, doesn't he fit category. And it's really looking at do we need to get a closer? Is Glenn Perkins going to be healthy? Is Brandon Kinstler able to step in and actually be a closer for the Twins long term? Do they need to address pitching, you know, with Hector Santiago, Phil Hughes, and some of these other guys, or do they have the guys ready and able to go at AAA and maybe converting them out of the bullpen or putting them back where they belong? So I'm really just excited to see what this team is capable of doing with a new front office, mostly the same coaching staff, and then just seeing everybody back and healthy again, too. If they can do it with this roster, then it starts to give you hope that they're capable of doing this long term, and it means that they don't have to go out and sign somebody to, you know, 80, 90, 100,000, you know, $100 million contract to make them competitive, because they have the pieces in place. And I think that's what Twins fans really should be looking at this season. As much as we wanted World Series, as much as you want to see them just, you know, blow the doors off and go 107 wins, seeing them progress, seeing them play more consistent baseball, more competent baseball, should kind of be that barometer this season, for as much as we don't want to wait another season for the Twins to get back into contention.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a valuation year where also Paul Molitor is going to manage as a lame duck, you know, on his final year of his deal. And so it's going to be a deal where he can show what he's capable of while managing for his job as well. So let's do this. Let's close with a couple position battles I'm looking at and who you think might win. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, so first one's backup catcher. I think your candidates are probably Chris Jimenez, Mitch Garver, John Ryan Murphy. In my first blueprint, I think I said John Ryan Murphy would be my backup catcher. Right-handed stick, good framing or good pitch receiving gives you a good complement to what Jason Castro does, a left-handed hitter, a good defender as well. But it really feels like they're going to push Jimenez here in, you know, the guys in Falvey and Levine are not going to be married to Murphy because they didn't make the Murphy acquisition. I think it would be a little bit foolish, though, to let Murphy walk away with the potential as a future starting catcher in the league. I still think it should be Murphy, but if they went with Jimenez, it would not stun me.
I think it's kind of the same thing, too. I think a lot of people have hope and faith in Mitch Garver, but it seems like he just needs a little bit more seasoning before they get comfortable even putting him in the backup role. I mean, if Ron Gardenhire was still here, I don't think he'd have an issue between any of the four of them, because he'd probably carry four.
Yeah, four or five, right?
Yeah. But, yeah, I think John Ryan Murphy would start as the backup, give Jimenez a little bit more time to get himself settled, and then give Mitch Garver probably, I would say, if he can be, you know, the everyday catcher, the starting catcher, you know, more days than not down in AAA, seeing what he's capable of doing there, then, you know, maybe he would be a good call-up in August, September, somewhere in that neighborhood. But I think I agree with you, and John Ryan Murphy is probably the starting day catcher with Jimenez a close second.
All right, how about the fifth starter? I think you're looking at Irvin Santana, Hector Santiago, Kyle Gibson, and who am I missing here? Are guaranteed. I'm missing somebody.
Phil Hughes.
No, Hughes. I think Hughes is who I have. I think that's your four guaranteed. Then your fifth is probably wide open. I know where you're going to go with Trevor May. I think I agree. I think you obviously have Duffy, Barrios, Vogelsong. You're going to have Tepish. Yeah, Nick Tepish is in the mix. And then Justin Haley, the Rule 5 guy as well. How do you see that panning out? Because, again, I think May still has an option. He could go to Rochester and stretch out if they really, really wanted to do that. But, you know, is Vogelsong the kind of pitcher that they really need to push other guys aside for?
No, I don't think that should be the case. I think he was brought in more as an insurance policy. If these guys just weren't figuring it out, you at least have a veteran in Vogelsong who can step in. You know, he's not going to win you. He's not really going to steal you any games, but he's not going to just flat out blow them either. You know that he has control. You know what he's capable of doing, and no, he's not the same player that he was even 5 years ago. But to me, he seems like he's that, you know, golden parachute in case things just don't work out. I really think, though, that it's probably going to come down to Tyler Duffy, Trevor May, and Jose Barrios. And to me, my ideal, you know, rotation and bullpen would probably have some form of, I would definitely say that Trevor May or Jose Barrios should be your starters.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Tyler Duffy should really be your long reliever. He doesn't have four pitches. I think he has two.
Two and then a changeup that he every now and then digs out.
Yeah, and then at least with Barrios and Trevor May, they have, you know, three, four pitches that they can rely on. And I think Trevor May was throwing a two-finger fastball, or he was adding another pitch to his repertoire.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but yeah.
You know, so to me, it seems like those guys would be better suited for that role. And I don't see that there'd be anything wrong with necessarily having Berríos or Trevor May maybe be that long reliever alongside Tyler Duffy, because we again know that not everybody in the starting rotation is going to stay healthy, and having those guys at least with the ability to stretch out over a week and get back into that starting role without necessarily having to swap guys back and forth as well would seems like it would be a better learning experience for both of those guys, or all three of them actually, considering they really don't have much left to prove at AAA at this point. So if you can find spots for them on the roster and kind of, you know, shuffle the deck chairs, as they say, I think that would be the best bet. I'm hoping for Trevor May as much as everybody's crazy about Jose Berríos, but it wouldn't surprise me if Tyler Duffy or Jose Berríos ended up with that fifth spot either.
So we got an update. Tyler Duffy was used in relief in this game.
Yeah, I saw that.
And gave up a grand slam to
Jake Bowers.
To Jake Bowers, so now it's 10-0 Rays.
Spring training, just got to keep telling yourself that.
Right.
So, Pete, how about left field? I think your mix, it's probably Eddie Rosario, Robbie Grossman. You do have J.B. Shuck. You also have Drew Stubbs and probably a few other bodies that are in that mix. I think you're going to be probably seeing Rosario starting. Grossman maybe DHing against lefties or playing against lefties and left a little bit, kind of move him around a little bit. But do you think there's any kind of flexibility there as well?
Probably tipping my hand a little bit here, but I would imagine your opening day starters would probably be Eddie Rosario in left field, Byron Buxton in center field.
Well, opening day's against a lefty, keep in mind, too. It's Danny Duffy.
True.
So it might be Grossman in left.
Okay, so my four outfielders to me would probably be Byron Buxton, Max Kepler, Robbie Grossman, and Eddie Rosario, with Drew Stubbs maybe being, you know, kind of a guy to mix in there as well to give some of the younger players some time off. If Eddie Rosario just goes into full-blown strikeout mode, you got somebody that you can throw in there, give him a day or two to kind of rest, get his mindset again too. And we know that Byron Buxton is very good defensively, but hitting-wise, he's still not excellent. We know that Max Kepler hits the cover off the ball when he's on a hot streak, but that is a streak, and that's not consistent and doesn't give you a full picture of what he's capable of doing. So I would imagine that Drew Stubbs would maybe be that fifth option unless he really impresses them in this offseason, in which case maybe they bump Max Kepler back down for a little bit again, which I really hope they don't do because I have very high hopes and expectations for Kepler this season. But I think I would go Grossman with what he was capable of doing and his ability to play most outfield positions, and he didn't look bad at the plate either. So I think those would probably be my four outfielders.
Okay, so then it brings us to utility player, because obviously Danny Santana could be considered a quasi-outfielder, but I know a lot of people don't really care for him. As far as utility, you got Eduardo Escobar, you got Danny Santana, you got A-Ray Adrianza, you got the outfielders as well. What does your bench look like if you were to have a four-man bench right now? So your catcher is going to be Murphy, is that right?
Yep.
So are you going to keep let's say you got two infielders and an outfielder, or one infielder and two outfielders. What is it going to look like for you for a four-man bench?
I think I would go with the two-man infield just based on the fact that we don't know what Miguel Sano is really capable of doing at third base yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to keep your Eduardo Escobars, you know, in that Danny Santana in that capacity. Yes, Escobar is not phenomenal. Danny Santana not necessarily phenomenal either, but I mean, if Miguel Sano isn't playing at a very high level defensively, I mean, you got to have somebody that you can slot in there and at least stop the bleeding at third base. I mean, especially when you have so many switch hitters and guys that are pulling the ball these days, too, that if he's just getting beat up defensively on third base, as great as an asset as his bat might be, you can't just throw him out there and just assume that he's going to smash a grand slam every game and put you back in the game.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why at this point I have higher hopes for Max Kepler, because he looks like a more complete player. He can hit, he can field, and he's not a liability in either of those categories quite yet. You know, time will tell if that's the case, but to me, Max Kepler seems like he presents a more complete package, and Miguel Sano is, what, 22, 23 years old right now?
Yeah, I think he's 23, 24 this year.
Yeah, you don't just want to throw him in the designated hitter position at this age. Jim Thome was a first baseman beforehand. Mike Piazza was a catcher Frank Thomas played first base. I mean, there were guys that turned into designated hitters that at least played defensive positions for a good chunk of their career before they switched full-time to DH. And if that's the case with Miguel Sano, I feel like there might be better options available for a guy that can at least hit 20 to 25 home runs, but at least play defense at the position he's supposed to. So I think for me, it's looking at Max Kepler, what he's capable of doing, looking at Miguel Sano, seeing what he's capable of doing, and then going, if he's only a one-dimensional player, are you really going to sign him long-term to be your DH and then just settle for another kind of revolving door at third base again? That's kind of where I'm at right now with Miguel Sano. I really want to see him improve defensively and also become a much more patient hitter. We know he can hit for power, but let's show the patience there too. Well, everybody hits, you know, everybody gets strikeouts now. Okay, that's fine, but we don't have to do that. We can get patient hitters that do great things and don't strike out 150 plus times in a season.
Okay, so real quick, so your fourth, and then your fourth would be your outfielder. Just real quick, who would your outfielder be then again? You have to remind us.
Robbie Grossman.
Okay. Yeah, so I think my bench would be something like, Murphy, Adrianza, Escobar, and Grossman right now. I don't know if they'll go with five and then shorten the bullpen and have a true center field option. I don't think you need that because I think all three of your outfielders can play center. But I think Danny Santana's on the outside looking in with Adrianza here. But that's what I got. That's all we got for you, Pete. Thank you so much for coming on, and sorry you couldn't make it up here for SmackDown tonight.
Yeah, it's a bummer, but I'll get my fill of wrestling this weekend, and I just have to enjoy it in Wisconsin. So, you know, hopefully there's some cheese curds involved, maybe a spotted cow or two.
All right, well, we'll have you on again real soon. How does that sound?
Sounds good, Brandon. Thank you very much.
All right, you've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.